From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. This is a shout-out to Al-Qaeda and also to the IRA, Hamas, the Tamil Tigers, and any Basque or Kurdish separatists within the sound of my voice. As an expert in the field of messaging, I advise and implore you directly, stop blowing people up. It wins you headlines, but not sympathy. Osama bin Laden, dude, this means you. Now, it's not likely that Osama bin Laden will heed my advice. Very possibly, though, I have just committed a federal felony. In a decision announced Monday, the U.S. Supreme Court found that advice to terrorist organizations, even advice motivated by a wish to end violence, is punishable as aiding and abetting terrorism. The New York Times' Adam Liptak wrote about the case. Adam, welcome back to OTM.
Thank you.
Can you tell me about the original prosecution that yielded this ruling?
Well, no one was prosecuted, but the case was brought by a couple of people and six organizations, all American, who said they wanted to provide advice of a kind that would further the aims of peace, to help a Kurdish group, for instance, that has a beef with Turkey, appeal to international organizations to help resolve disputes peacefully. So these folks went to court to say they feared being prosecuted because it seemed that the plain terms of this law reached them, that even benign assistance amounts to material support to terrorist organizations. Nobody disputes that if you give terrorist organizations money or bombs or tangible stuff, that that is the kind of support that can be used for terrorist ends. The question is, can you give intangible speech-related advice and assistance to these groups and not be subject to this law that makes it a crime to provide material support?
Now, Chief Justice Roberts worried aloud about the free speech implications of this ruling, but then ultimately said, oh, well, you know, you can't make an omelet without breaking some eggs. Can you break down his reasoning?
Well, he made three basic points. He said that whenever you give terrorist organizations anything, you're freeing up resources for them to do bad things. I guess presumably because if they had to go out and pay for this advice that you're giving them for free, that would, you know, take money that they would otherwise be using to blow things up. He said that any kind of engagement with terrorist organizations legitimizes them. And in its briefs, the government said, listen, we want to make these people radioactive. We don't want Americans engaged with them, coordinated with them in any way. And finally, he said that it could strain United States relationships with allies if Americans were seen to be giving any sort of assistance to these groups.
But how could they conclude that speech, which is so heavily protected under the Constitution, constitutes actual material support?
The line the Chief Justice drew, well, he drew two of them. One is, he said, first of all, we're only talking about foreign terrorist organizations. We're not saying the government can make it a crime to help domestic groups of any kind, even terrorist ones. But the more important line that he drew was saying, we're not stopping you from saying anything you like. You yourself can go to the UN and petition for any claim that you want. What you can't do is coordinate your activities with theirs. But the lawyers in the case raised some interesting hypotheticals the court didn't grapple with. One was, well, you know, the Washington Post and the New York Times have published op-eds from the spokespeople of Hamas, one of the organizations designated as terrorists. Why isn't that giving them a kind of outlet, a kind of assistance? What if you wanted to file a brief on behalf of one of these groups? What then? Those are hard questions we didn't get answers to, but certainly the logic of the decision suggests that the Times or the lawyer wanting to represent one of these groups could well be committing a crime.
So have I just committed a federal felony by directly messaging Al-Qaeda et al. With my advice to stop killing people?
Well, it does need to be expert advice, Bob.
All right, that'll be enough out of you. Let me ask you about Elena Kagan. She is the nominee for the vacancy on the Supreme Court. She's also the Solicitor General of the United States and argued the government's position against free speech in this circumstance. Does this give us any window into her thinking if she were on the bench with the rest of the justices?
She not only argued it, Elena Kagan said that this deserves no First Amendment protection at all because this is conduct, not speech. The court rejected that position, which was an aggressive one. Whether this tells us about anything Kagan would do on the court, probably not. She was a lawyer representing a client, and her own academic work, a lot of it was in the area of the First Amendment, and it was quite sensitive to concerns like this. So my guess, based on her academic work rather than her litigation for a client, would be that she would see a lot of merit in what the dissenters said in this case.
So I gather that what we have to hope for is that federal prosecutors do not get overzealous in taking this decision as somehow carte blanche to prosecute every loudmouth or do-gooder who wishes to influence terrorists. Is it ever good law if we have to hope for prosecutors not to be too extreme?
The question answers itself, Bob. Obviously, anything that gives prosecutors too much discretion to make just about anything into a crime is problematic. The majority here thought the law was narrowly tailored enough and put people on enough notice that you don't have to rely on prosecutors. But it remains to be seen whether people will know where that line is drawn and whether prosecutors will be overzealous or not.
All right, Adam. As always, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Good to be here, Bob.
Adam Liptak covers legal affairs and especially the Supreme Court for the New York Times.
Remember Citizens United? That was the controversial 5-4 Supreme Court decision back in January that drastically changed the rules for how corporations, unions, and nonprofits can spend money during an election. The High Court decided that they may buy ads explicitly supporting a political candidate and that those ads may air at any point before an election. Supporters of the decision called it a victory for free speech. Opponents said it opened the door for corporations to decide elections. This week, the House passed H.R. 5175, or the Disclose Act, to counter the court's ruling. The bill forces corporations, unions, and nonprofits that use their funds for political ads to disclose the names of their top donors. But the Disclose Act has come under attack, not just from those who oppose it on principle, but because House Democrats agreed to exempt the National Rifle Association and some other large nonprofits from the requirement that they disclose the identities of their top donors. The Democrats agreed, because if they didn't, the NRA threatened to kill the bill. Maryland Democrat Chris Van Hollen is the main author of the Disclose Act. He says, despite the exemption for the NRA and others, the bill serves a crucial purpose.
We believe voters have a right to know who is paying for the ads that they're watching, and this bill would require lots of disclosure. It also prohibits foreign-controlled corporations from spending any money to influence American political elections and prohibits large recipients of federal dollars, like major federal contractors or big banks that receive taxpayer monies under TARP, like AIG, from taking that money and recycling it back into political advertising.
How much of the bill is a response to the Supreme Court's decision on Citizens United?
Well, the bill is a response to a very radical decision in Citizens United where the court overthrew decades of established law to find that corporations would be treated like individuals for the purpose of spending money on campaigns. Before that, corporations and unions were prohibited from spending money directly out of their general treasuries. After the Supreme Court's decision, they could all receive and spend unlimited amounts of corporate money in campaigns. They're barred from doing that under this bill.
So now let's talk about the controversy, the exemption for the National Rifle Association. In what way is the NRA exempt, and in what way isn't it?
There's a provision that says if you have 500,000 or more dues-paying members, you don't have to do all the individual reporting under the bill.
The exemption only involves naming the names of individual donors. And you didn't mention this. Would the head of any corporation or any public interest group who produces an ad have to come on at the end of it and say, my name is thus and such head of this corporation and I approve this ad, as now happens in candidate ads?
Yes. The organizations would have to identify themselves, and the CEO or senior representative of that organization would have to stand by the ad. For all these reasons, the groups that have dedicated themselves to campaign finance reform and transparency, the League of Women Voters, A Common Cause, Public Citizen, Democracy 21, strongly endorsed the bill, even with the adjustments.
Now, what we've read everywhere is that the NRA would have lobbied against this bill and killed it if this exemption had not been made. So what were they afraid of?
They did not want to disclose those who made donations to their organizations. And the argument given by the large organizations with citizen members were, look, we're not going to fool anybody as to who we are. Whether you love us or hate us, the voter understands who the Sierra Club is and that they're an environmental group, or the NRA, that they're a gun group.
You know, even with this exemption, the NRA has publicly said it doesn't support the Disclose Act. It's just agreed not to publicly criticize the lawmakers that vote for the bill. Was it worth it, given all the flack that you've taken for these exemptions?
Well, the fact of the matter is that this bill remains the strongest piece of transparency and public disclosure bill the Congress has ever passed.
Do you think the NRA could have killed it?
What we do know is that when we had legislation here to give the District of Columbia representative voting rights, they did. And the other groups opposed to this legislation would have liked nothing better than to see the NRA do their work in defeating this bill.
Congressman, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Chris Van Hollen is a Democratic congressman from Maryland. The NRA took a lot of heat, mostly from conservatives, for agreeing to sit this one out in exchange for the exemption. Critics say the NRA should have used its lobbying power against the bill. The NRA declined to speak to us, but it has recorded this voicemail, which outlines its position on H.R. 5175.
We'd like to set the record straight. We have never said we would support any version of this bill. The initial version of H.R. 5175 would have effectively put a gag order on the NRA during elections and threatened our members' right to privacy and freedom of association by forcing us to list our top donors on all election-related television, radio, and internet ads and mailings. We refuse to let this Congress impose those unconstitutional restrictions on our association.
Coming up, a reporter who enjoyed special access to a general and wrote a story that ensured he'll never enjoy that again. Why is that so rare?
This is On the Media from NPR. This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Today I accepted General Stanley McChrystal's resignation as commander of the International Security Assistance Force in Afghanistan.
In case you, by some miracle, missed this development, the head of military operations in Afghanistan, General Stanley McChrystal, resigned this week over insubordinate remarks made by himself and his staff about the president, the vice president, and others, recounted by freelance reporter Michael Hastings in Rolling Stone magazine. In an interview with WNYC's and PRI's The Takeaway, he explained why he reported what others did not.
In the past, the general has given pretty good access to a number of journalists, and I believe those journalists were interested in painting sort of a flattering profile of the general, which assures you more access in the future. I understand that, but it's not something I'm interested in doing.
As a freelancer, Hastings isn't bound by the same unofficial rules that beat reporters often live by. Jamie McIntyre was a beat reporter, the senior Pentagon correspondent for CNN for 16 years. This is his theory of why such lofty military officials would speak so candidly in front of a reporter.
They got very comfortable with Michael Hastings and believed that he would probably follow the convention of many beat reporters and not report some of the hijinks that go on behind the scenes.
Let me ask you now to describe the difference in the dynamics between a beat reporter on the defense beat or any other and someone who parachutes in for one story.
Well, the difference is the sort of one-off reporter doesn't need to worry about whether he's going to get future access or not, whereas the beat reporters, like when I was at CNN, I needed access. I needed to be able to get to the key people to find out what was going on when bombs were dropping or things were happening. And the way you do that is you forego reporting all of the sort of off-color jokes or informal banter that goes on when you follow these guys around, focus on the big picture, and they begin to trust you. as a result, when you need to know what's going on, you get access. If you do what Michael Hastings does, they're never going to talk to him again. Of course, he doesn't care. The fallout from that, though, is that they may also not talk to a lot of other reporters as well.
Not reporting the off-color jokes, the intemperate comments, and so forth. You called that the dirty little secret of beat reporting.
You know, it implies this sort of overly cozy relationship. These military officials that we're following around, they're not our friends. We're frenemies. We're not friends. You know, one thing we've learned from this whole episode is that military officers cannot tell you what they're really thinking without being in peril of losing their jobs. So the dirty little secret is, yeah, we sort of informally agree not to report a lot of things that we see and hear, some of it for legitimate security reasons and some of it because it could just be embarrassing. And the trade-off is we get a continued relationship with these people and we can get information. And by the way, it is information that we can still hold them accountable for. It's just that we sort of cover them.
Can you give me any kind of concrete example about a story that you may have let go for the sake of ongoing good relations with your subjects?
There's been a lot of things that have happened on Rumsfeld's plane when I was traveling with him that would be great stories. I actually think a lot of them provide some real insight into Rumsfeld, the man, and how he operated during the time he was defense secretary. But the agreement is that stuff on the plane is off the record.
All right, Jamie. Now, I can tell you that there will be comments beneath this interview on our website that say Jamie McIntyre has rationalized the ongoing of a sleazy dynamic between defense reporters and the people they're covering. He's drunk the Kool-Aid. He's breathing his own fumes. I want you to tell me a concrete example of how suppressing some colorful little background can yield some very serious reporting later.
The last time I was in Afghanistan, I traveled with then NATO commander Jim Jones, who's now the National Security Advisor. I followed him all around. In fact, he even took me into some extremely high-level meetings under the condition that I could observe, but it was off the record. And that kind of access, where I got to see, you know, what really goes on behind these doors where the reporters are usually left outside, was extremely valuable to me in calibrating my reporting. You know, none of these generals, the smart ones, they don't want a free ride. They just want to know that they're going to get a fair shake. And I think the ultimate measure is you have to go back and look at the reporting and see how it holds up over time. And if you look at the reporting and you decide, you know what, Jamie McIntyre missed it. He didn't get it right. And it may have been because he was too close to his sources. Then you can make that judgment.
I have to ask you if the fair shake that you're talking about for you would have extended to not reporting this pretty clear-cut case of insubordination that General McChrystal and his aides displayed.
Well, I have to say, I think Michael Hastings did exactly the right thing. Part of the Uniform Code of Military Justice bars contemptuous remarks by military officers about their commander-in-chief. So if I witnessed a military officer violating the military law on this subject, I think I would be bound to report that. But if I asked the general, what do you think about the president's policy? And he said, can we go off the record? I would know that if I don't go off the record, I'm not going to hear what he really thinks. And I might be willing to do that to find out whether the generals really believe in what they're doing.
I want to come back to the ultimate consequences of the Hastings story on McChrystal. Is this going to make it very tough on beat reporters and freelancers from this point forward?
I think you're going to see a sort of a freeze out for at least a short period of time. Don't forget, it was just in 2008 that Admiral Fallon was forced out because of remarks that he made in an Esquire magazine. You would have thought after that, people would have been very gun-shy. But the fact of the matter is, it'll go back to the way it worked before, which is it's all based on trust and relationships. It's a two-way street.
Jamie, thanks again for joining us.
Thank you.
Jamie McIntyre, an adjunct professor of journalism at the University of Maryland, blogs about the military and the media at lineofdeparture.com.
3 years ago, journalists Sebastian Younger and Tim Hetherington embedded in Afghanistan with a platoon of the 173rd Airborne Brigade of the U.S. Army. The unit was stationed in a mountainous region near the border with Pakistan called the Karengal Valley. And over the course of 10 months, Younger and Hetherington filmed soldiers on patrol, under attack, and during the boredom in between. No snappy dialogue, no witty banter in the heat of battle. The men we see set up camp, meet local elders, trade machine gun fire with the Taliban, sit around playing guitar, get injured, and die. The full fog of war was on display when the platoon learns that they may have accidentally killed and wounded Afghan civilians, including children.
He said that there is 5 guys already dead, and 10 of the females and kids already.
So
they are injured, you know. Show me which of them is the Taliban. There is no Taliban.
The film, called Restrepo, after a fallen platoon member, opened this week in New York and Los Angeles. Sebastian Younger, who directed and produced the movie with Hetherington, says the unit's mission was to help bring security to the valley.
Karengal was being used as a base by insurgents, a sort of waypoint on the trail, literally a foot trail, from Pakistan towards Kabul. Also, you know, from the Karengal, insurgents were attacking the Pesh River Valley. It's a big population center, a big mobility corridor. And so when they put these small bases into the Karengal, it stopped the attacks on the Pesh. So that actually was a sort of important effect.
So you show up with a camera. Other than that, you're basically carrying the same gear as the other soldiers. But what did it take for them to get over their natural suspicion of you?
I did 5 one-month trips, and my partner, Tim Hetherington, also did 5 one-month trips. Sometimes we were together, sometimes not. The first trip, you know, they were polite. They were a little reserved. We got into a pretty good firefight, and after that, I showed them the video that I'd shot. They'd never seen themselves in combat before. That was a nice moment. By the second trip, I tore my Achilles tendon on a patrol and had to sort of crawl and limp through the next 4 weeks. Tim broke his leg in combat and had to walk all night on a broken leg to get down off this mountain. If he'd been a crybaby about it, he really would have endangered the platoon. There was no other way of getting him out of there. And then I got blown up in a Humvee that got blown up. None of us were injured physically, but it made an impression on me. You know, after all that experience together, I was friends with those guys, and they really stopped thinking of me as a journalist, I think, in the negative sense, and started to think of me as kind of a sort of weird person in the platoon that wasn't carrying a gun.
For the first half of the movie, the platoon is hunkered down on a hill overlooking the valley in an outpost they built themselves called Outpost Restrepo, after the name of a fallen friend, and then Operation Rock Avalanche, the low point in their 15-month deployment.
Rock Avalanche was the low point in the sense that they took a lot of casualties. They went down into a essentially enemy-held village called Yakachina, looking for weapons caches and insurgent groups. And then they moved on to the Abascar Ridge, and they were attacked by enemy fighters that had crept into the American lines, whispering on their radios because they were so close. The Americans couldn't figure out why the Taliban were whispering on their radios, and later they realized because they were, you know, 50 feet away behind some rocks. Tim was right there. He's got footage of all of this.
The anguish of one soldier, when he becomes aware of the death of Sergeant Larry Rugel, it's heartbreaking.
Yeah, an American position got overrun, and Sergeant Rugel was the scout leader, and one of his men realized that his scout leader was killed and just broke down sobbing.
There's nothing we can do.
Where's everybody else?
Hey, we got friendlies here. Friendlies to our six right there.
Iyenberg, all right. Who's
Solo.
Vandenberg's already
got him. Getting him.
They're not stable right now.
Medevac right now.
Who's that? He's sorry.
2-6, 2-6, 2-3.
You're lying right, man.
Battle 6 Romeo's is 2-6. Right now we have the hilltop.
Very, very intense, traumatic moment. But, you know, these guys are really well trained, and he sobbed for a couple of minutes, and he straightened up and became operational again, and, you know, he was a soldier.
You don't see graphic images of the casualties. Is that a choice you made or, you know, part of the embedding agreement or a request from the soldiers themselves?
The U.S. military has a very light hand in terms of what you can put in your work as a journalist. You can't compromise security, obviously. And there are issues of privacy with wounded soldiers. There's actually no mention in the contract that you have with the U.S. military of filming dead American soldiers, but graphic images of an American soldier who's identifiable by his family would be so traumatic, so painful that, at least for me, that's sort of the first thing I thought of when we tried to evaluate, okay, how do we show the violence of this scene without adding additional trauma to the people who loved this guy who died.
Did your personal engagement with the platoon have an impact? It had to have. On what you filmed, you know, did you think maintaining any kind of level of detachment was important in the situation?
It's such complex territory. I mean, to get the film we wanted, we had to become part of that platoon so that we were not seen as outsiders by the men. But you have to remember that we were not trying to make a political film. We were not trying to evaluate the overall war morally, politically, strategically. There are other great journalists who are doing a great job doing those things. What we wanted to do was to capture what it's like to be a soldier in combat in the U.S. military. Our guiding principle was we would limit ourselves to what the soldiers had access to. We didn't interview any generals because they can't. We didn't talk to the families because the families were not part of what was happening out there. We didn't even have an outside narration to explain to viewers what was happening because there was no narrator in the Korangal Valley as the story was unfolding. Our objective was extremely narrow, which is to understand their emotional experience. Their emotional experience is completely subjective. They're not stepping outside of themselves to understand the Taliban. So, you know, we didn't either.
One scene that struck me as stunning, weirdly, was when one soldier was setting up a very heavy gun, having this conversation with this other soldier on the radio who's asking him about the ranch he lives on. It's this strange juxtaposition of charming, dumb conversation with this awesome weapon and the prospect of death looming over them. It was crazy.
The weapon was called a Mark 19. It's an automatic grenade launcher. And he was on a radio talking to his buddy in the next guard position, which was, you know, 15 feet away.
Your family owns a ranch?
Of course.
Like cows and pigs and chickens and horses ranch?
No.
Like what kind of ranch then?
It's like a ranch just with like land, you know, with gates and stuff and trucks and whatnot.
These guys were up on that hilltop for a year. They had no television. They had no internet. They had nothing. All they had was each other and combat. So they became very good at entertaining each other. The wonderful old human tradition of conversation and humor.
The soldiers talk about the ultimate high that they feel at one point and how they'll never be able to duplicate it stateside.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the adrenaline is definitely a component, and it's the most obvious component, so it gets discussed the most, even by the soldiers. But what they really missed, and this came out later in interviews with them, what they really missed wasn't so much getting shot at. Getting shot at is terrifying. The soldiers get scared just like journalists do. Adrenaline isn't really ultimately the issue. It is this sense of being necessary. These guys are 19. They're 20. Back home, they're not necessary. They're another teenager walking down the street looking for a job. They're at the bottom of the food chain. Over there, they have social status. They have respect. They're part of a small unit. That sense of belonging is literally intoxicating to young men, and it can't be achieved back home, even on the football team.
You've actually spent more time in war zones than the soldiers you've covered.
I was in more combat than those guys had been when they got there, for sure. It started in Bosnia. I was in Kosovo and Liberia, Sierra Leone. My first trip to Afghanistan was 1996. In all of those wars, I'd been with militias. This was the first time I'd been with a professional army that had very clear rules of engagement. They understood the consequences of violating those rules of engagement. It was a completely different experience. I mean, it's like comparing a street gang to the police.
Michael Hare in Dispatches, it's a memoir about covering Vietnam, and he wrote that some of the soldiers were very warm and friendly, but some of them hated him. And he imagined that they thought, why would you be here? Why would you treat your life so casually? We have to be here.
Well, the difference is that the soldiers in Afghanistan don't have to be there. They all volunteered. So they do understand the personal decision involved in sending yourself to a war zone.
Explain it to me.
Well, it depends on who
you are. I'm talking about you.
It's important work. You know, the wars that happen in the world are tragic, often unavoidable, and I think almost always stoppable. And they get stopped when the press reports on the tragedy of it sufficiently to trigger international action. No one did anything about Liberia for years, and finally the U.S. forces stepped in and brought the war to a stop literally without firing a shot. Sierra Leone, likewise with the British SAS, they went in, they fought for about 10 days. I don't think they lost one soldier and they brought that war to a stop. Bosnia, the same thing in 95. NATO stopped that genocide. 250,000 civilians dead. All of those wars were stopped in part because of press coverage. So if you're part of that endeavor that brings these stories to light and affects some change, for me, it's just an incredible honor to be able to do that. And there's a risk and there's a reward. And I very carefully monitor those two levels because I don't want them to get skewed. But there is some good that comes out of this work, which is worth a certain amount of risk. And every person calculates those two levels personally.
How many more wars are you going to cover?
You know, you can cover wars in different ways. You can cover wars and not get shot at. Or you can be with frontline troops and understand what it's like on the front lines. I don't think I'm going to do that again. Every trip I did out there with those guys, something very bad almost happened to me. And I really had the feeling that I was just kind of spinning the chambers on the revolver over and over again. I don't want to do that anymore.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Sebastian Younger is co-director with Tim Hetherington of the documentary Restrepo, which opens this weekend in New York and Los Angeles, and nationwide the following weekend.
I want you guys to mourn, and then I want you guys to get over it and do your jobs. Okay?
Coming up, if you're partial to an illegal movie download or two, you'd better watch your back. One law firm has made it its business to find you.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. In recent years, lawsuits against individuals downloading copyrighted material have become rare, largely due to backlash against the deeply unpopular legal tactics of the Recording Industry Association of America. The RIAA's Sue the Pants Off of College Kids campaign was suspended in 2008, traded for a strategy of pursuing software companies such as LimeWire that create programs enabling piracy. But this year, the lone downloader is in the crosshairs once again. A consortium of enterprising intellectual property lawyers, styling themselves the U.S. Copyright Group, has sued more than 14,000 defendants, not alleged downloaders of music, but alleged downloaders of movies. To give you some perspective, the U.S. Copyright Group has sued nearly as many individuals in 5 months as the RIAA did in 5 years. Nate Anderson of the blog Ars Technica says this new round of lawsuits isn't a means to curb piracy so much as one to monetize it.
That's right. They go to independent filmmakers and they tell them, we will go out, find people who are sharing your films, send them these settlement letters, demand that they pay us $1,500 to $2,500, and if they don't, we can take them to court. We will split all that money with you on a contingency basis. I think the thing that concerns some of the people I've talked to about this approach is that if you went to a lawyer to try to contest them, even if you were innocent, it would cost you more than if you just settled the money. So people have to make these sorts of decisions.
And guilty or innocent, I guess it feels like a shakedown.
Well, that's how many people feel. In the settlement letters that we have seen, the lawyers do promise that if they take these people to court, that they will go after the most damages possible, $150,000 per infringement. That was something that the recording industry was never willing to do. In the only two court cases that went all the way to trial, the RIAA would never set that sort of dollar figure on it and always left it up to the juries.
Now, it kind of reminds me of those TV commercials and subway posters trolling for plaintiffs on personal injury, asbestos cases, and so on. Is this kind of ambulance chasing?
It's clearly different from what the recording industry was trying to do. If you ever talked to the recording industry about their lawsuits, you'll know that they were insistent that it was about education, that they wanted people to understand that sharing this material violated U.S. copyrights. It was not about making money. And in fact, they have always said that their campaign, which was 5 years long and went after 18,000 people in the U.S., was a money loser. This appears to be very different from that.
So how does this law firm go about identifying potential culprits?
They have partnered with a firm called Gardelay. What they do is monitor BitTorrent downloads. They can see which internet protocol addresses are sharing parts of these files. And then these cases are filed, 2,000, 4,000, in some cases even 5,000 anonymous users at a time. And the lawyers ask the courts to help them turn these IP addresses into real people's names and addresses.
And the internet service providers have to comply?
If the subpoenas are valid, the ISPs would turn over the information of their subscriber who is using that address at that particular date and time. Time Warner Cable has been objecting to the subpoenas on the grounds that they're unduly burdensome, and they are trying to get the courts to either quash these subpoenas or cut them back radically.
Now, the lawyers are also running into another obstacle at a D.C. district court where a judge has asked them to explain under what basis they're suing 4,500 John Does at a time. If the lawyers are obliged to start suing people one at a time instead of en masse, are they going to be out of business?
Certainly, it would put a tremendous cramp on what they're trying to do right now, because when you have to file separately, you have to pay a federal filing fee for each one of those cases. You have to file individual paperwork and respond separately to motions in every particular docket. They have already filed 14,000 cases against these anonymous defendants in 2010 alone.
So let's just say that the U.S. Copyright Group is permitted to continue business as usual. Maybe half of the money they recoup goes back to the producers of the film, who themselves have been victimized by piracy. Isn't this kind of just fine?
There's two real concerns with the approach. One is the amount of money involved here. I think it's debatable whether being hit out of the blue with a demand to pay $1,500 for maybe one film you downloaded, or you could face a $150,000 penalty, you know, it's really a proportional response to what happened. The other question is whether everyone is in fact guilty. And it's clear that that's not the case. So then the question is, how many people were innocent and how many of them just decided to settle rather than dig up a lawyer, pay several thousand dollars just to try to prove their innocence?
Because they say it may have happened at their IP address, but not while they were at the computer. They didn't download anything.
I've heard from some people who said they've gone around and interrogated every member of their household. Everyone has denied it. They can't find any evidence of these files on their home computers. And I think it points to the basic issue in all of these sorts of prosecutions, which is that an IP address does not identify a person, but a machine, usually somebody's router. That router can be sharing their internet connection with just about anyone, especially if it's hooked up to a wireless network. And it's very difficult to know if your son or a friend of your son or, you know, a visitor or the person next door in the apartment ever used that connection to do something illicit.
All right. Nate, thank you very much.
Great. Thank you.
Nate Anderson is a senior editor for the blog Ars Technica.
By his own account, Tom Bissell has spent hundreds, perhaps thousands of hours shooting people, stealing cars, destabilizing African countries, shooting people, massacring zombies, navigating post-apocalyptic worlds, and shooting people. To be fair, some of them were trying to kill him, but still. Video games are nothing, if not games, but for Bissell, in just the last 4 years, they have become a wildly addictive, almost compulsive habit, consuming more and more of his waking life. It's not that he was deliberately avoiding his life. Bissell's days have been spent in varied and prolific enterprise, writing novels, short stories, essays, criticism, and dispatches as an embedded reporter in Iraq. But nothing in recent years has matched the thrill of looking through the eyes of a character in first-person games like Grand Theft Auto or Far Cry 2 and doing whatever the game required. Bissell's account of his video game years is called Extra Lives: Why Video Games Matter. Tom, welcome to the show.
It's wonderful to be here.
A lot of the critique of video games in general comes down to violence, especially first-person shooters, which are spectacularly violent. How do you answer the violence critique?
A lot of the games that people decry, you know, what is happening to our kids, they're not really made for kids. But the first thing is that most games are not violent. I tend to like violent games, the same reason that I've worked as a war correspondent, the same reason I wrote a book about a war. I'm interested in violence. That said, there's some games that have interesting stuff to say about violence and some games that just treat it mindlessly. And, you know, both can be fun, but the ones that really affect me are the ones that actually try to address the subject. There's a game called Far Cry 2. It takes place in a contemporary African civil war. It's extremely beautiful. And yet, it is just the most unrelentingly savage game I think I've ever played. Most games that are violent give you the gun, push you in the direction of the bad guys, and say, hey, go kill all those guys. They're bad. You'll be rewarded. Good job. Far Cry 2 does something really confounding. Going through the game, quote, getting better at killing, the game kind of introduces slowly that you're actually not helping things, that in fact, you're kind of the problem. Everything you're doing is just making this conflict worse. So by the end of the game, you're just a wreck. You're progressing through the game because that's what the game's asking you to do, but it's also throwing all of this stuff back at you that's actually shaming you a little bit for being a participant in this virtual slaughter, and I love that about it.
Does it give you the option of, say, joining a UN peacekeeper force or a diplomatic delegation?
It absolutely does not. No, it doesn't. In Grand Theft Auto 4, they created this really tormented, kind of awful character named Nico.
During the war, we did some bad things. And bad things happened to us. Maybe that is no excuse. But I need money. This pays, and I'm good at it.
Nico is trying to escape his nature, and that's what the game is really about. Nico is fundamentally a bad guy, but he has a decent sense of right and wrong, and you sense that he kind of wants to do the right thing. Now, the problem is that the game actually asks him to do bad things throughout the entire game, and he does them with varying levels of enthusiasm. To me, the really riveting part of the game was rooting for him and trying to play it in a way that honored my conception of him, which was as a legitimately tormented person.
You're animating Nico.
You're both observing him and you're also portraying him, which is this really weird thing that video games do.
And when critics criticize video games, notably Roger Ebert, for instance, said that video games can never be art. You noted that he came to this conclusion after watching people play a game, which you said is akin to watching a movie with the picture turned off.
Yeah, it's exactly what it's like. You know, this is a real problem with video games. Learning how to play them with any level of skill or enjoyment requires you to learn this foreign language, which is the language of the controller, the language of gameplay, the kind of sense of where useful information is going to be found on the screen or in the interface systems. And so there's no doubt that games have several very large conceptual boulders blocking people who might be inclined to think highly of the form's potential and yet can't get there because of this weird interface system the games have evolved to have.
You point to a kind of game avant-garde that's trying to challenge almost everything about how games are designed and written. But games are really big business now, rival to the movie industry. Is there a financial incentive to take risks? Do enough people want the smart, emotionally, and morally substantive games that you say you want?
That remains to be seen. I don't think so. The biggest problem with games is the fact that they are such big business. And it's one of the most risk-averse industries in the world. I mean, they make Hollywood look like avant-garde poetry publishers. There are enough people, I think, who are trying to push the envelope creatively. But the problem is every time a game does come along and tries to push the envelope creatively, oftentimes the people who will jump on it hardest will be gamers, which reinforces the company's sense that gamers don't want new innovative stuff. And then we go back to year zero, and then we're all in this very unhappy place where every game that comes out either has an elf on the cover or an M16, where you swing hula hoops around your head and throw things at hippos. And everything just feels kind of ghettoized, kind of boring, to tell you the truth.
So why did you write your book?
On one hand, it's an attempt to make a case for video games' artistic legitimacy. On the other hand, it's an attempt to explain to people who are convinced by video games' artistic legitimacy why their case isn't as good as they think it is. So I wrote the book because I was a literary writer. I wrote short stories, I wrote literary journalism, and I played, you know, video games lightheartedly and didn't really expect much more out of them than fun. I think around 2006, 2007, I started to notice that video game storytelling was actually getting really kind of good. Which isn't to say most video game storytelling was good or is good. In fact, most of it is quite clumsy.
You can't get past how bad the writing continues to be. The dialogue, sometimes the plots and the character development. Why are those parts of the games so slow to develop?
Well, it's a far more complicated question than it seems. At first blush, it's just that the people that grew up designing video games just didn't have a lot of formal dramatic training. Because of the culture that ignored the importance of really addressing questions of dramatic motivation, the medium sort of is stuck with a kind of clumsiness at the core of it. And there are things inherent to the video game medium that create this really weird push and pull between the creator and the audience, and they kind of wrestle for meaning in moments. And so the author figure is saying, this is important, do this, and the gamer is saying, I don't want to do that. The stories can't ever really quite gel or be coherent in the way that we've come to understand storytelling.
Because no one is entirely in control?
Exactly.
It's very hard to have a strong narrative structure when the experience is created both by the designers of the game and the gamer. You make a point of saying, you know, that what books allow you to do is to inhabit the consciousness of another person and experience a kind of visceral empathy with a stranger. Is that getting better in today's games?
Well, no, and I don't think it really can. I really think if you work in a medium, your point is to bring out what the medium does best. As a fiction writer, what I seek to achieve is that sense that you, the reader, has entered into another human being who is suddenly a living person, and you are getting a guided tour of their mind. And that is the thing that I love about fiction, and that's the thing that only fiction can give you. And so all of the juice of video game storytelling comes from those moments in which, for instance, at the end of Grand Theft Auto, Nico has this run-in with someone who betrayed him. Nico's been looking for him the whole game. It's the moment of recognition, and this man is like a pathetic, drug-addicted wretch, and Nico has the gun to his head, and suddenly the game gives control back to you, and you have to decide what to do with this guy. Do you walk away, or do you kill him? Your impulse is to show him mercy because you're a human being, but at the same time, you can't forget what Nico has sort of suffered because of this guy. That is the kind of storytelling that I love about games. It actually gives you this unbelievably scary and weird and often very troubling kind of agency. And fiction can't do that. Movies can't do that. That's the kind of things that I love about games, is those moments of just jaw-dropping, scary freedom.
Let's talk about compulsivity. First of all, you describe an unbelievable amount of productivity. You are able to write so much, so quickly. And yet, you wrote, I woke up this morning at 8 a.m. fully intending to write this chapter. Instead, I played Left 4 Dead until 5 p.m. The rest of the day went up in a blaze of intermittent catnaps. It is now 10 p.m. and I've only started to work. I know how I will spend the late frayed moments before I go to sleep tonight, because they are how I spent last night and the night before that, walking the perimeter of my empty bed and carpet bombing the equally empty bedroom with promises that tomorrow will not be squandered. I will fall asleep in a futureless, strangely peaceful panic, not knowing what I will do the next morning and having no firm memory of who or what I once was.
You know, I'm totally aware that games have taken some toll on my ability to concentrate, my ability to write certain kinds of things. I mean, 6 years ago, I wrote a 50-page essay on Solzhenitsyn. The idea of doing that right now is inconceivable to me. Right now, I'm very committed to bringing the emotional resonance I want from game experiences into games, and I'm working in games a little bit right now, and I'm determined to try to do this. I realize that it might not work. I'm not going to be able to figure out how to tell a new story in literary fiction. That medium's formal problems have been solved long before I was, you know, a mere babe. This is a medium that is actually open to more directional influence from smart people working within it than maybe any other popular medium around right now. And, you know, if I'm going to go there and get crushed for the sake of, you know, increased game storytelling sophistication, I willingly place myself under the cruel mistress's boot heel.
Tom, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Tom Vissel is a fiction writer, essayist, and critic. His new book is Extra Lives, Why Video Games Matter.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Mike Volo, Mark Phillips, and Nazanin Rafsanjani, with more help from Alex Goldman, Michael Chaplin, and Brett Jaspers, and edited by Brooke. We had technical direction from Jennifer Munson and engineering help from Robert Granis.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer, and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist-composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find transcripts at onthemedia.org. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter, or email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm the one who isn't Brooke Gladstone.
He always says something like that. Then we just wait a while and he'll go, "Oh, wait, I have an idea. Why don't I try it like this?"
I have an idea. Yeah, let me take a different approach. Let me try it this way. And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from LendingTree, whose financial tools include Loan Coach, offering personalized advice for every step of the lending process at LendingTree.com. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing. Or
politics.
Country music.
Hockey.
Sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.